Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
This is Front Row, The Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. A little under a year ago, I was introduced to the photographs of His Royal Highness Sultan Ismail Nasiruddin Shah, the fourth Yang di Pertuan Agong of our country. There was an exhibition of selected works, about 35, that were printed on the now discontinued Kodak Actualier paper. Don't ask me what this paper is. These photographs were mostly in black and white, but some were hand-colored using a Japanese technique called Zokingake. A public exhibition of His Royal Highness photography is being organized at the Islamic Arts Museum, and his grandson, Raja Ehsan Shah, both the archivist and researcher of His Majesty's works, is here in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
I suspect that few of us know that he was a photographer.
I first started showing his work publicly 20 years ago now, but the level of exhibition or promotion-wise was not consistent. Some people say, I just appear and then disappear, and again I appear, you know, like that. And then his photographs were not shown since his demise in 1979. He was quite well known
during his time
in the 50s and all that. But history has to be documented properly. And through time, people just forget, and only a certain number of people from that generation remembers.
Interestingly, that you should use the expression certain people of his generation. If you look around BFM, most of those who are engaged here are 30 years old and under. And I ask him about the fourth Agong. They can say, yeah, this is the fourth Agong. But do you know that he was a photographer? And they will all give me this blank stare. Few of us know about his photography.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Like I said, in 1997, when the first retrospective was in Petronas, a lot of people didn't know. And they were the older generation than the present generation. Yes. A lot of people don't know still.
Tell us about his photography. Like, how did he get started?
He started at the age of 16 when he was given a camera.
Can you recall what camera that was?
I know it was a Kodak, but I can't remember the actual model.
Whether it was a Kodak Brownie or
no? Yeah, probably a Kodak Brownie.
Because that one came out quite a long time ago. It was like late 19th century. And by the year 1900, it only cost $1 to get that camera.
Yes. I don't know how much that would be in present day terms, you know. But I do have from his archives price lists of Leica equipment sold in Singapore. But this is the 50s, films and everything. Unfortunately, I don't have much info of the 1930s. But mind you, this is Kuala Terengganu. We're talking about his hometown where he got his camera. Where he actually got the camera from, he can't remember.
And but there was a gift or something he bought?
It was a gift. I'm not sure whether it's a gift from a member of the family, but this has remained a mystery. Even in his interview in 1958 in the Singapore Free Press newspaper, he actually said he can't
remember.
Recall. And he also can't recall what happened to the camera. He lost it. But he began to pick up again when a camera shop first opened in Kuala Terengganu in 1928 and was owned by Fernandez Brothers. Last time I checked, they still had a shop, but they were selling fabrics. And I think what it was selling everything, you know, on stage, trading and everything. So he managed to get this Speed Graphic and Kodak Premio camera. That's when he went around taking photographs. And to the bemusement, I think, everybody was puzzled.
Why this young man is pointing a camera at them?
He said in... people questioned him. It was like he was labeled as someone who had too much time on his hands. So he had the skills from the age of 16. Of course, when he didn't take photographs, but I'm sure it's all in his mind. Everything is like pictured in his mind. But he didn't get the second camera until about 4 or 5 years later. It's credit to him that he actually made the decision to seek the expertise of a Japanese cameraman. Expatriate who had a photo studio
in Kuala Terengganu.
In Kuala Terengganu. What's happened in the last few years was very unfortunate. there's an old photo studio, Yamada's photo studio, and the shop by Fernandez. I think they were all in one block. It's all been destroyed now. And little do people know, that's where photography started seriously, I think. When there's actually evidence that modernism took place there, in terms of photography at least, yeah.
So after he got hold of this camera, he took lessons from this Japanese expatriate?
Yes, yes. When I was doing the research and all that, nobody could actually tell me what he was doing. What he was physically doing, yes. What hours he took photographs. But what he was thinking of, nobody could evaluate. So the only way was to go through his photographs. Not what he took over 2 years or 3 years, but I had to look over a span of 30, 40, 50 years. I'm pleased to say even 2 years ago or even last year, I discovered more and more things. I discovered his series of photographs he took on Penang Hill in color, which was 1953 or 54, in medium format, and of the old Malaysian airport, all in color and even black and white. So I was discovering new things all the time. I think I have come to a decent conclusion. This new discovery just confirms what I have been thinking, rather than something completely new. He was going forwards and he was going backwards. He was forwards, meaning he was embracing changes in the style of photography with the cameras that came out and the printing techniques that came out. It was sharp focusing. It was gelatin silver print making. And his print making is like the Japanese way. It's very simple, very straightforward. Normally it's the cropping and all that. There was nothing fancy about him. He didn't do any sepia tones or any of those things very much. But he also went backwards, meaning it's like the picture history started in the mid-19th century. Everybody who took photographs in the first maybe 80 years, 70 years of that, wanted to replicate paintings. So we have this title called pictorialism. Just because you take a landscape doesn't mean pictorialism, because that's what people tend to think. Pictorialism, you must have, of course, the style. You must have the camera, which is bent on soft focusing. There's no sharp focusing. Then you have this printing technique, albumen printing or gum bichromate. So all this must come together for a photograph to be called pictorialism.
I guess in the early days, folks thought of the camera as being just a device, and you rarely think of the cameraman as being, or the photographer as a creator. You are just supposed to just press the button and capture what reality is out there. But of course, what you're saying to me is that, yeah, there was a lot of art in that.
Well, the French painters, the Impressionists, followed a lot of the Japanese woodblock prints. When it came to photography, they did the same, actually. Because the Japanese, true to their ukiyo-e zen mentality, took photographs in a very different manner. And the West then started realizing, going to follow this as well. So if you say it's a device, then why is not everybody taking film the same way? So like the now very well-known series by the father of Japanese photography, Shinzo Fukuhara, Paris and the Seine River, is so dreamy. Everything's a dreamscape, more so with the Japanese, I think. And the cropping and the shadows and the space. The photographs illustrate space and loneliness in a landscape and all that. The lone person in a landscape is typical.
Before we go further into talking about photography in the larger picture, let's continue about what happened to him. So where did he take his photographs in this early period? You say he was following this Japanese expatriate and learning from him. What did he learn? Did he learn the technique of taking, the technique of seeing, or the ability to understand what he was seeing and trying to capture, or the skills to print?
I think he took everything. He does. He does have his favorite places, and he keeps going back to the same place, and he sees things that others may not see. But all the things that I've said just now, that the man in the landscape, recurs a lot in his work. The concept of space. Of course, Trengganu had a lot of space, and it was ideal for him to do that, you know.
And I guess Trengganu allowed for that because you have beaches.
Yes.
And during that point in time, we have lots of land and just open spaces.
Yep, exactly. There's this photograph called the Iba, the man pushing his sampan. The man is pushing it to the right of the picture, and he's placed almost at the bottom right corner. So you have this really empty space in the back. And that is actually a concept of the Japanese woodblock prints that was applied to still life. But he applied it to real life. But he did shoot something like that of his work desk in his dark room, where his ashtray, his silver favorite ashtray, was placed exactly where the boat was. And you have this empty space in this table. That I see. It was the Japanese connection.
How would you describe his interest? What did he take pictures of? One, you did say landscape, but I understand he also had portraits.
No, I think he loved portraits most of all. I came to a conclusion not so long ago that there's hardly any landscape. There is landscape, but there's always people in the landscape. For example, I think the most famous photographer, American photographer, would be Ansel Adams. He shot landscape with nothing in it. The wilderness.
Yeah, no human being in sight.
My grandfather could have done that easily in Trengganu. That's why I need any people around anyway. But he didn't. So he always had emphasized life somewhere. Yeah, I think it was only the riverscape when there's actually total absence. And then he had a studio, an indoor studio where he...
His father must have given him the space to build a studio.
I think he made do with what he had in the... When he became the sultan, he moved from the Istana Masya, which is now a ceremonial palace, to the Istana Badaria, built in 1939 by the same architect who built the Singapore Supreme Court, which is now Singapore National Gallery. He converted a room in the early 50s and filled it with tons of equipment. And there was a Brita Haran editor, at that time based in Singapore, who visited him... And his studio in 1958, I think. And he said it could rival any studio, or even better, any studio, professional studios in Singapore. Basically, they had so many lights, and it was like at the switch of a button, you will see the background. But he doesn't take pictures with elaborate backgrounds, very minimal. Light will be opening up space, and darkness will be closing up space. But mainly, he loved to have a black background.
So that studio was built when he became...
The Sultan.
The Sultan, mm-hmm. And in Trengganu, he had this space that he created for himself to escape into the dark room to do some printing?
Yes, yes. The dark room was somewhere else. The studio was somewhere else. The first dark room then became a dining room for guests or other people on the ground floor. Then there was a purpose built, really nice. This was a really nice dark room.
Actually, I'm very interested to find out, when he became the Agong,
yes,
what happened to his photography? I'm speaking with Raja Ishan Shah, gallery owner and researcher and caretaker of all things related to the photography of His Royal Highness Sultan Ismail Nasiruddin Shah, the fourth Agong of our country. Coming up, more about the royal photographer and modern photography, but we'll find out when he became the Agong, what happened to his photography? Did he just park it aside? This is Front Row in the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. You're tuned to Front Row in the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. In about 10 days after Chinese New Year has settled and just before the malls rain down hearts for Valentine's Day, an exhibition of some works by His Royal Highness Sultan Ismail Nasiruddin Shah will be held at the Islamic Arts Museum. It is in this context that Raja Ishan Shah, the grandson of His Royal Highness, is here. Raja Ishan is also the keynote speaker at the launch of the exhibition. Just now, Raja, we were talking about how as the Sultan of Trengganu, he created rooms within his palace so that he could continue with his photography. I'm interested to find out when he became the Agong, and that was in 1965. So he was by that time 58 years old. What happened to his photography then?
First of all, he transferred some equipment, actually bought some new equipment in Kuala Lumpur and set up another dark room.
So he didn't stop.
He didn't stop. I think what happened was he loved to print. He had many photographs that he didn't print years earlier. So it gave him an opportunity to print in his leisure time. But his photography did suffer because he took lesser photographs. After he became the Sultan of Trengganu again, when he came back, that he shot a lot more photographs, but mainly color at that time.
In the earlier days, before he became the Agong, he took photographs, but he didn't print them. So as the archivist, did you discover lots of unprocessed films?
Oh, definitely. I think his most famous portrait, and a lot of people's favorites, is Mariam, the old lady, which is actually on the close-up of her face, is on the cover of the book I wrote 3 years ago. And this famous Mariam picture is of her weaving in a Malay house, weaving the pandan as mat. And I know then we have this side profile of Mariam, the one on the cover of my book. But I then discovered last year, just loose negatives in a little plastic box of Mariam doing other things at a table, also weaving and also doing other things. That's when I also found Kadir, the fisherman, in the studio with his nets and his paddles.
So these were all composed shots. He got them to sit in the studio and he took pictures of them. But you know, I assume Mariam was a real weaver and Kadir was a real fisherman.
Yes, they were. They were both.
I thought they were fantastic models. You know, because they made such great models. Maybe you could just describe Mariam weaving at the table. I mean, the background is quite dark.
Yes.
In fact, the table is barely lit. It looked as if Mariam was just standing waist deep in some kind of a darkness.
Yes, that's right. And the features of Mariam as well. You know, he loves this thing called chiaroscuro, you know, black and white. Balance.
High contrast.
When it's too much black,
yeah,
it becomes very heavy.
Yeah.
When it's too much brightness, it becomes too light, the picture. So he had to find this balance. And Mariam's hair were all silvery white. You know, and it balanced very well with the background. A bit more light is on that table where she was once, and this is the Japanese influence, touching a Japanese doll. It's not in this exhibition.
Uh-huh.
And this exhibition actually is all about unseen photographs. But I tell you, the selection was incredibly difficult. What to leave out, especially.
Maybe because you're too close to the subject.
Yes.
No, actually, I love the photograph. Not only that Mariam has this interesting face, but in this photograph, she is wearing her glasses or her spectacles, big framed, and sitting on the bridge of her nose, kind of low on her nose, and as if she's looking through them and down, like how older people tend to wear glasses.
Yes.
And then she's looking at her hands, and I notice she wears a ring. Wedding ring in the left finger, left hand ring finger. And you can see how focused she is.
She was in her own environment, in her own elements, you know.
Even though she was in the studio.
Yeah. There was another lady, this one with a selendang, with a loom. That's another story. I don't know the name.
While he took all these portraits, he also took pictures of like the Welt supermarket.
Mm.
It's just like a documentary photograph. You don't think of it as like looking at Kadir or looking at Mariam and just say, oh, you know, you are drawn to it. If I were to go through an exhibition, Welt supermarket would be just one I look at and I'll move on to Mariam.
Yes, you know, like modernism, street photography is very, very, very essential part of modern. I think one of the great characters of modernist photography is street. And you can define the street in many, many ways. And he defined it in his own ways. In 1957, he defined it by looking at the people on the street, the poor people on the street working, not at all interested in the architecture or the hustle and bustle that goes around it. This Welt supermarket was shot, and I didn't realize this, it was shot during the May 69 curfew.
No wonder it was so
empty. What threw me off track was because the May 69 Kuala Lumpur Berkurung series was in a roll of film, negatives. This was after that, and it was mislabeled as 1970 Kuala Terengganu.
Who mislabeled it?
Someone in the darkroom. But sometimes it's difficult because the film runs from one to another and all that. And half is of KL and half is Kuala Terengganu. Half of it was right. It was in Kuala Terengganu 1970. What confirmed it was that the next picture was the military presence in the Istana Terengganu. So that's it. That's it. It cannot be this empty. What supermarket was very busy then? It was probably the supermarket. And people get excited when they see that.
So if you didn't know the story, you just think this is, for me, not realizing what year it was taken, because from where you displayed it, there were no dates given. I was looking, it looks very documentary in terms of, here is a building, KL with a huge supermarket. But now the way you have framed it, suddenly it's a different story.
The architecture of the well, it was very unique as well. It was all cubes. And it reminds me of a cubist painting, like a Bousier and kind of things, you know. That was my first impression as well. And apart from the fact that, like I say, almost everybody who lives in Sarawak KL goes to the World Supermarket at that time. But then this new bit of info, or this new bit of conclusion, really makes it a more exciting, more relevant picture, I think.
We have kind of talked about his portraitures. You have mentioned that his interest in people, and even though we are looking at the World Supermarket, we are actually seeing the absence of people. So people are really still present in an indirect way. But there are also photographs where he went into like kampongs. Like the one that grabbed my attention was the pondok classroom.
Oh, yes.
Classroom without walls. Probably it's a one-room class, one-room school.
Yes, probably.
And with an atap roof. On the side, you have all these bamboo poles holding up the rafters. Mm-hmm. And students, about 30 of them, in five rows of seats. But the rows looked like they were built from bamboo. And the top of the desk were also looked like bamboo. Mm-hmm. From our 21st century perspective, looked quite rough.
Yes. Very rough, actually. That's true. That was very close to the communist areas, actually. He went there. He was shooting against very strong light at the back. So we had to work a bit on this print. And there was a very nice board at the back.
Yes,
It was legible. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I could see still the Queen's portrait at the back. Queen Elizabeth, I mean. There is also a Malaysian flag with less stripes. Malaya Federation of Malaya flag. And I wish we could read what's there.
When was that taken?
57, 58, I think.
So it was the time before he became the Agong, so still must be somewhere in Terengganu then.
Yes, yes. He travelled through Terengganu and felt a bit more ease. I did speak to his butler. I asked him why. Why is it, it seems to be less, apart from being the Agong, I think. When we got independence, I think over the next 3 years, the output became a bit less. And his ability to go out was less. Security was imposed on him during that time. He went less into the kampong. But he did shoot a lot of colour photographs, and he still documented a lot of things. But I think the really serious, expressive works were in the 50s.
What's your relationship to your grandfather's photography? Are you yourself a photographer?
I was taking photographs when I was young, although my grandfather always discouraged it as you grow.
Why would a photographer discourage a young person who's interested in photography?
I think he felt that he's spending too much money on it and all that. And he doesn't want to see others
waste their money.
Oh, yeah, too passionate and too exuberant with this hobby of his. Yeah. But he gave me decent cameras all the time.
So your birthday presents were cameras?
Or related ones, probably. But I'm quite happy because in looking for the negatives in the last 2 years, because I took out a lot of color, and I found some of the shots that I took when I was 8, when I was 7. And I took portraits of him, portraits of other of his friends, portraits of Sultan Perak, Raja Azlan. Actually. I just found this a few years ago. And I was doing this. Then I took, of course, landscape and the odd street scenes and all that.
Were you a subject of your grandfather's photography?
Quite a bit. And he would print. There's some pictures in Japan. One, me seated in a kimono, or the Japanese kimono, yeah. And elsewhere. And there was like 40, 50 of the same prints. I can't remember what they were for.
How old were you then?
From 9 to 12. Okay. That was a lot. 8 to 12. And I think what happened was he made Hari Raya cards. Or New Year cards. And he used to have his own prints. I don't know how many, maybe 100. And then he pasted it on the cards. So I think I've seen that cards that were made, he made for me. So I can only assume that they were pasted on the cards that I sent out.
And then you send them out, yeah.
Yes. I can't remember sending it out to anyone. So you must have sent them out for me. How can you explain so many prints of a certain... Only one shot, you know.
He was interested in photography and he was very much a photographer himself. In what ways did he contribute to photography in Malaysia or Malaya then and then Malaysia?
He must have built a fantastic reputation before the war, because the war interrupted everything. And for him to be asked to become one of the patrons, the first patron probably, of the Photographic Society of Malaya, was due to that reputation. I don't think they just picked him up out of nowhere. think he always contributed in the sense that he participated with them. So, and then there is a subject of a new book, whether he was a salon photographer, meaning part of the club circuit. Well, he was a patron, so he tried to participate as much as he can. But he was the loner that worked in the Far East Coast, in a corner, you know, somewhere, doing his own thing, not bound by any rules or anything of that sort, you know. And he provided money, meaning prizes, medals. I was recently contacted by a Singaporean collector who collected medals, and someone sold him a silver medal for the Pictorialist Photographers of Malaya. This is the 1957 31st August exhibition, the wow, Merdeka exhibition.
It's worth a bit of money now.
Badly kept, you say. I think badly polished. But still, sure. I would like to see the gold medal, but this was one that he did. I was also told by an ex-Kodak manager for Malaya, also a former president of the Photographic Society of Malaysia. And he said it was so easy to get support from him and all that. And if you they had an audience with him, he would quickly just give his agreement and without having to wait, go straight to the office and get your check for whatever you need for the exhibition. And of course, he opened every single international photo exhibition all the way to the 70s.
I'm going to ask you to speculate on this. Had he not become the Sultan or the Agong, do you think he would have become a professional photographer?
No, I don't think so. Because in those days, some of the best photographers in the world were amateurs. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the first commission photographer was Berenice Abbott when the New York City asked her to document, and also Walker Evans, I can't remember these names, but these photographers to document the effects of the Great Depression, the suffering of the people, you know, Berenice Abbott for the architecture of New York. Apart from that, I think he would have just remained an amateur.
So it was hard to earn a living being a photographer.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So much better to be a royal photographer then.
Yes, I suppose. Like I said, he was always a photographer. It's not he took photography after he became Sultan, but he was a photographer, amateur.
I've been talking to Raja Irshan Shah. He's the caretaker, archivist and researcher of the upcoming exhibition, Almarhum Sultan Ismail Nasiruddin Shah, Unveiling the Unseen, 1937 to 1971. This photography exhibition will be held at the Islamic Arts Museum in Tasik Perdana from February 8th, which is a Wednesday, until Friday, March 31st. And on Wednesday, February 8th at 3 p.m., in a special presentation, Raja Irshan Shah will be speaking on the photography of His Royal Highness titled Defining Modern Photography in the Context of Malaysia. Gallery hours are from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., including public holidays. Admission tickets are RM14 for adults and RM7 for students and senior citizens. That's a regular fee that the Islamic Museum charges for anybody going to see an exhibition. And this exhibition will be held in the Open Gallery.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.